Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to this special live edition of the Seneca Podcast, coming to you from the Princeton U.S. China Global Governance Forum, a marvelous event put on by the Princeton U.S. China Coalition. Terrific to be here for this podcast recording. You guys want to make a little noise? That was so worthy. I'm totally flattered. And anyway, I am Kaiser Guo, and I am glad to say that the Seneca Podcast has now been running for 8 years. Jeremy and I started it on April 1st, 2010, back when we were both living in Beijing, and here we are now in April 2018, him living in Nashville, Tennessee, me living in North Carolina, and doing this show for a living now when it just started off as a hobby. And that is thanks to SupChina, which I needn't remind you is the best way to stay on top of the latest news coming out of China in just a few minutes a day through our free email newsletter and, of course, on our website. We've got loads of great original writing, amazing photography, a growing stable of podcasts, and lots more. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. As those of you who listen regularly to the show might remember, back in March of this year, we had a show we recorded in New York with Sichi Tu and Eric Fish. We're talking about the Chinese student experience in the United States. This is a topic which I imagine is one near and dear to many of your hearts. We talked about the pressures that they are under, the social and academic and increasingly the political pressures, as allegations of Chinese influence operations and all sorts of incidents involving politics become more frequent. So you can think of this as sort of part two of that episode. Our guests on that previous episode study the situation, but today we're very fortunate to have with us somebody who has legit lived it, experienced life here in the U.S. As both a high school student and a college student. And indeed, he even served as president during his senior year at USC of the Chinese Students and Scholars Association, an organization that has come under quite a bit of scrutiny for its alleged ties to Chinese consulates and embassies. So he's won many, many awards, mainly for being super young and unreasonably successful. Bloomberg Businessweek 25 under 20, Forbes 30 under 30 award. I think we could keep going numerically by fives, but I'm not going to, because that would just make me feel shitty. And, you know, please, everyone, welcome Gao Yutong, Tony Gao, founder and CEO of the company Easy Transfer. So, some of you here today were able to hear Tony speak earlier about his experience as an entrepreneur. Yes, at the tender age of 23. You're only 23, right? Oh, yeah. My God, dude. He's already a serial entrepreneur, but we're not really going to focus so much on that, but rather about his time studying in the U.S. And because he's a problem solver by nature, we're also going to get his perspectives on some of the many issues that now confront Chinese students in the U.S. and, you know, issues that are confronting the educational institutions that those students attend. So, Gao Yutong, let's start with some basic facts about you. So tell us, where were you born and where you spent your childhood before you went to the U.S. at the age of 16?
Yes, so actually I was born in Beijing, raised up there for 15 years. And I'm like the typical Chinese student, raised up by the grandparents. And actually my life is kind of different, not that typical though. So my life, I went to the boarding kindergarten since I was 3 years old. And after that, all the way in the boarding school until 15 years old. Then when I was 15, I started to search for the schools, and eventually I found the boarding schools in Nebraska, Omaha. And then eventually, like, I actually transferred there as a sophomore student and start my journey from there, though, with all the cornfields and, all-boys schools. My experience is really unique, but really loved it, yeah.
You didn't have the easiest time when you were in junior high, as I understand it, when you were getting ready for the zhongkao, for the high school exam. You were telling me earlier as we were walking around campus about some of the experiences you had, nearly being expelled and all this stuff. So tell me, what was life like for you then?
Yeah, so since my kindergarten and the primary school, like, it's all boarding. So that school is like, they do not focus that much on academic. So they want to actually prepare you in all the things, all the fields, instead of like the traditional Chinese schools focusing, like, let you focus on studying all the time. So my school, they don't have like all the like preparatory like program for all the math class. And it actually came to me like really hard when I start to prepare for middle school, since all the middle school, the great middle school in China, they required the examinations before you enter the school, and that's really selective. So I actually like to get into that middle school, I spent a lot of time preparing for a test, doing like thousands of questions repetitively, and eventually, luckily, I was involved in that school. But the thing is that once I get into that school, I realize that all the friends around me, they're really, really strong. And in other words, like, kind of aggressive. They want to get the best score, and like, they try to compete with each other. And since I was not that kind of student, I am not that, in academic-wise, like, I'm not that strong. So like, I was like under huge pressure, which lead to me like one solution to stand out among the students is like always to prank in the class. So what I do is like I did a lot of different stuff in the class. Every time when the teacher says something, I always have like other things came up. And eventually, like when I was in the eighth grade, the teachers, the class, like not the teachers only, but like more like the directors of the school.
Uh-huh.
She was dreaming about I was like just taking the walls of the school down. And she was worried about that so much. So in the next morning, she asked my parents to actually take me to the hospital to see whether I have some kind of like a disease or not. So otherwise, like,
based on a dream.
Yeah, based on the dream.
Okay.
And that's crazy.
Maybe she's the one who needs psychiatric care.
But eventually, I was lucky enough. I did not have like any like kind of like illness or disease. So I was able to survive in that school, keep my spot, not get like expelled. But like eventually, like my parents think I really need like the other environment to let me enjoy studying and learn what I want. That's really important, though.
So you decided pretty early on then, or rather your parents decided pretty early on that you weren't going to attend university or even high school in the United States, or in China, that they would send you to the U.S. instead. So already you were sort of off that Gaokao track, right?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. How much of a say did you have in choosing the school that you ended up attending? You ended up attending, if you weren't here this morning, a boys Catholic school, boarding school, in Lincoln, Nebraska, in this place surrounded by cornfields and more cornfields. So, this was clearly not your choice, I'm imagining. I mean, what red-blooded 15-year-old boy chooses that dire fate for himself?
I mean, like, my parents, although they're really strict, but they can open, though. They talk to me, like, gradually. So, like, they let me know there's a great school, like, know the rankings, know all the facilities, all the sports, like, all the teams. And I think the life there, it should be, like, really interesting, besides they don't have girls. So, for me, like, my parents spent, like, 3 months trying to persuade me to go to that boarding school. And eventually, I just take the offer. I was like, if I can really work hard for 3 years, I could get into the dream college, and then that could possibly change my life. So I really like end up of like being in Omaha, Nebraska, like with all the cornfields all the time. But eventually, that place really changed me, changed my life.
Yeah. What were some of the reasons that they wanted you to go to this particular school, though? I mean, I'm sure they had their reasons for choosing it.
Yes, so in China, a lot of parents, if they want to send their kids to study abroad, they're kind of worried about the school's dynamic or the environment. Because nowadays, every single year, we have around 400,000 Chinese students coming to different countries to study abroad. In the U.S., the number is about 150,000 students upcoming every single year. So all the parents are worried that even though they send their kids to study abroad, the problem is that all the Chinese kids will get together and they will talk to each other in Chinese.
Yep.
Like never like learn American culture, eat Chinese food all the time, and eventually like they will get back to China after they graduate. So my parents, like, they don't want me to become the typical like Chinese international students here, and they want me to really learn the American culture. So that's why they sent me to Midwest, which like that place has no Chinese before. In my high school, I was the first one in the school's history, and eventually I learned some American culture, but like still, like I'm more like the banana, like although like I was born in China, but like I tried to learn the American culture, but it's still hard for me. Yeah.
So that's interesting that you at least tried to learn American culture. I mean, I have a daughter who's 14 now. She was 12 when we moved to the States. And in this whole time, she has been completely immune to the seductions of American popular culture, whether television or literature or music even. Instead, she's completely wrapped up in East Asian culture. It's Japanese manga and anime. It's Chinese silly television shows and sitcoms and whatnot. And of all things, K-pop. That I can understand. I mean, that's some pretty great stuff. Now, K-pop is great. Now, my son, though, he came over when he was 10, and the moment he stepped off the plane, he started speaking a language I've come to call YouTubese, which is just basically strung together internet memes. I mean, it seems like that's how he knows to speak. You know, he's an aficionado of hip hop and knows everything that's happening in American popular culture up and down. You know, watches all these shows, and it's just so weird the contrast between them. Where do you fit in this spectrum? I mean, were you immune? Were you pining after Chinese culture? What happened to you when you came?
Yes, actually, I was kind of the hybrid type. So I love the food, I love the movies. I love all the superhero movies, the Marvels. Like I watch that all the time. And eventually, like when I get here, I really want to get involved into the groups. So I try to get friends from the American society. I talk to my classmates all the time. And during the weekend, if they want to invite me to their houses, I will try my best to make it. But the problem is, problem arise when it came to the deeper level. Once we were friends for a month or 2 months, they start to get the conversation much deeper. Like the conversation involves with all the cartoons such as SpongeBob. I never watched it before. And
you
also
never watched SpongeBob?
Never though. I don't even know that though. In China we watch what
It's called Haimian Bao Bao.
Yeah, Haimian Bao. Yeah. So I never watched that before, and always the conversation end up there. So I was kind of embarrassed all the time. And although I try really hard, but the reality is that because the environment you grow up with, they don't have that. So if you really, really want to catch up with that, get involved, you really have to catch up with all the information they have when they're in the childhood. That's really, really hard, and it takes years for you to complete.
So how did that impact you? I mean, you're obviously not an introverted person. You're quite an extrovert, and you made the effort, right? You made the effort to connect with these guys. But we were talking earlier, and you were talking about how you would be sort of, really, what's the right word? Ganga, just awkward. Yeah. I mean, there would be these moments where you just couldn't continue a conversation because you didn't have the context or you didn't have the background. How did you deal with this? I mean, did you experience that same sort of alienation and loneliness that a lot of Chinese students have described on coming here? Or
actually, yeah, kind of after the second year, I feel like one thing really puzzled me, because when it comes to the prom time, the homecoming time, before 3 weeks before prayer, all my friends will gather in some house parties, and they will invite me to their houses. And I feel kind of embarrassed, because all the time, when I try to approach a girl, and I found the conversation end really quickly though, and there's no way for me to just get involved. So after that, I even think about just stop trying that hard to get involved. Or even I try to just get friends with the Korean students, Japanese students. At least we have a lot of things in common. Then that's easier to get along with. So that's the reality though. And although all the Chinese students, I believe they all try really hard to try to get involved. But some problems or issues with the culture just list it down there. It just exists, and no one can change that though.
But I have to say, I mean, there were clearly some advantages that were conferred on you by the fact that you went to a school with no other Chinese kids, right?
Yeah.
You know, talk about that. I mean, your English, your command of English, for example, right? I mean, it's much better than a lot of, you know, boys, at least especially who come to China from China and spend only a few years here.
Yes, I mean, I can have to practice the English because, like, I'm really a talkative person. No one can stop me, like, for talking. And in that environment, I try to, like, talk to friends all the time. And the best part of being in the Midwest is the people are really friendly. They try to, like, help you all the time. And I still feel lucky to actually get involved into that high school because, I mean, like, if I go to the Eastern Coast, no one probably will talk to me, though, and I'm become the lonely boy, and, like, I probably will get involved, like, along with all the Chinese students together, like, become the typical, like, students, yeah.
I see a lot of people in the audience looking at each other knowingly, so that I'm taking that as an affirmation of the universality of this experience. What's interesting to me is that your father was actually a visiting scholar here in the U.S. at a time when a very different kind of student came to the U.S. from China. China had very different economic circumstances and, of course, very different political circumstances now prevailed both in the U.S. and in China. Then you went on to USC, which I think stands for the University of Spoiled Children, right? And,
A lot of Chinese, yeah.
And did an undergraduate business degree at the Marshall School there. And that's kind of a departure, too, because, you know, back then, nobody did an undergraduate business degree if you came, or nobody came for an undergraduate degree, in fact. You know, so something that, you know, your father's generation, which I think is really my generation also, they had a very different experience here in the U.S. Could you contrast the experience of you and your father in the U.S.? I mean, I know that's a huge question, but I mean, what do you think are some of the most salient, the biggest contrasts?
I mean, at that period, because a lot of Chinese students, they study abroad, at my dad's like a generation, they came out because they were sponsored by the government,
right.
Or like they just study really, really great, and they want to become the top researchers or like just maybe like become the professors after they get the degrees. They went back to China to help the others. And so at that time, they really don't have the choice to make decisions on their degree or like their future. So they come here on the others like people's will, and they don't learn what they want to learn. They just learn that for the community. But for our generation, I feel like a lot of parents there right now really open-minded. They want their kids to learn like whatever they like, whatever they want to do like in the future for their whole life. So I mean, like right now, if you see the generations is like the idea, like the thought is totally different. In the past, like they just want to do the things that is like really prospecting in the future, have a lot of potentials, a lot of possibilities or opportunities in the future. Then they choose this major, and then like no matter how they like it or not, they just stick with it and spend 4 hard years and eventually go back to China or like try hard to stay here. But for right now, for our generation, like we actually become the students who can actually pick our major.
As long as it's not the social sciences or humanities. Right?
But like I see, like right now the students are really have much more opportunity to really learn what they want, and I'm really glad that we're born in this generation.
Yeah, I'm absolutely glad of that too. I think that it's fair to say that one of the differences between your father's experience and yours, the reason is China's rise. I mean, in the course of literally just this one generation, things have changed so profoundly in the number of Chinese students that have come. You were saying 150,000 new students every year. I think there's something like 350,000 at any one time studying in recent years. In the relative position of these students, in the kinds of students that come, the personalities of the people who tend to come, the opportunities that they have in front of them here. You are obviously not typical of your generation, but I think you are in a position because of the work that you do, because you know you deal with them so often. And because of, you know, the positions that you've held, to comment on, I mean, make some generalizations about the students who have come in more recent years. So I have a bunch of things that I want you to comment on about this generation and how different it is from previous generations. So let's start with this. Academic preparedness. Do they come as ready to absorb, you know, the full riches of a 4-year American education as people did in the past?
Well, I feel right now they're much prepared compared to
more
the past.
More prepared.
Okay. Sorry, yeah. And especially when the students, like before they enter into the U.S., like the education, like the test system actually helped them to like get better prepared.
Okay.
They have the TOEFL and SAT exam, but that's the system. But besides that, like they really like to try to learn the American culture before they enter into the U.S.
Right.
So we were mentioned about the Apprentice. The shows.
No,
so,
not The Apprentice.
God. Yeah, and I mean, like, we were talking about the presidencies in the U.S., and we were questioning that why the Chinese students, they don't talk about the government in the U.S. that much. And one topic I brought up, like, really interesting is that when we learned English in the education agencies in China, like, the teachers actually ask us to watch the movies or watch the shows. Some of the shows recommended are Friends. Is one of the show, and The Apprentice is the other. So a lot of the Chinese students, they know Donald Trump, not because he's the president, but they kind of like admire him since he's a successful businessman. And
wow.
That actually lead to the favor towards him. And so, I mean like, but like in this way, like the Chinese kids, they definitely like know more about American society. Like although like it might be like goes to a certain direction, but like compared to 20 or 30 years ago, they definitely like get more prepared compared to the past.
Why couldn't it have been The Sopranos and Seinfeld? I don't understand. Damn, we missed out on an opportunity. What about in their ability to assimilate or to interact with non-Chinese students? How do you feel they are in that way? Are they more? I mean, I feel like there's things that are pulling them in both directions. On the one hand, they are more open personalities who have been exposed to more Western culture. On the other hand, there's just so damn many Chinese students now that they can. I mean, it's like expatriates when they go, you know, to study in China. They end up hanging out together and not learning any damn Chinese except for Pijiao and Cisuo and Mei Guanxi and Han Mafan. I mean, it's just.
I mean, like nowadays, like I see a really interesting fact. That although a lot of Chinese students, once they get here, they gather together, but one thing really stand out is that I feel nearly all of the Chinese students, once a while, they want to join an American fraternity. And that is really interesting, though.
That, on top of The Apprentice, it's just they've ruined them already.
But the thing is that they to be able to join in the fraternity, they have to really go to the networking like events, like for at least 3 or 4 times within 1 week. So they actually try really hard to get involved with the society, and from there we can tell that they're much more open, like compared to the past like generation.
You know, they're walking down the wrong path, though, right? I mean, they have to understand that. I mean, what about in their interest level in the American political landscape? We talked about, you know, maybe they're not so engaged, but certainly more than before. It was like pulling teeth, I remember, back when I was in graduate school and I'd meet these other. They weren't interested in civics at all. They weren't really interested in the mechanics of the American political system. They weren't interested in the politics or the personalities or the issues or, you know, what it was that we were discussing. Now, what about now?
I mean, for politics, I mean, like, students, they, interesting fact, during the elections last year,
uh-huh.
As I was in the USC, we went to the our broadcast building, and all 3 levels was filled with all the people watching the election together. And from there, I personally saw a lot of Chinese students are there. And although they are, half of them are supporting Donald Trump, but like they're kind of energetic. I feel like right now they read more news about the government and the politics, and eventually I feel like in the future the trend of them will get more involved and more care about the relations between the two countries. Especially right now, a lot of questions are like a lot of issues are happening really threaten their futures for studying or like staying in the U.S.
Right. Maybe they'll finally understand. Yeah, interesting. What about the basic personality? I mean, there are levels of, say, introversion versus extroversion, whether they're as risk-averse as they used to be, maybe they're more risk-takers than they are than they were back then, and their ambition, their confidence, maybe their sense of optimism or pessimism. How would you describe the sort of personalities? I know there's, of course, a huge range, but
yes.
The center of gravity has shifted, right?
I feel like overall the trend is becoming like a more opened, happier, more optimistic. And the best part is that they're being more like the risk takers. So one thing can really tell, like in the past, if the students really have the idea, they want to go out to a startup, students from China barely take the gap year. But right now, like they start to take the gap year. That's really a big move. And besides that, like a lot of schools, they do have the program supporting the international students. This makes the students become like really bold about choosing their future career path. So like, for example, for my school, for USC, they even have the career like fair for Chinese students only.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Okay. So like, we could tell like a lot of Chinese students, like they are more involved with the campus, and from there they get like a lot of confidence, and eventually like they just get along better with the society, and eventually they have more opportunity, they become more optimistic. And I feel like this generation really could tie these two countries together with more like opportunity or like just chances though.
Interesting. We hear a lot about how political attitudes toward their own home country, toward China, how those change or maybe are reinforced sometimes when among this newer generation, the people your age, the post-90s who come here, what do they, how are their attitudes? And maybe even talk about your own feelings about your Zuguo when you came here.
Yeah.
And how that changed.
Yeah, so before I actually came to U.S., although like every Monday in the school, we signed the national like rhythm like every single morning, like with the event, raised the like a flag all the time.
Sure.
Yeah, in the school. Like, but the thing is that once I actually start to study abroad, the first time I feel like I was like really really proud of being the Chinese students. Cause in my high school I was the first one, and the rest of the international students, we have only 30 international students, 28 are Korean students. And one from Rwanda. So at that time, interestingly, the Korean students, they know that I won't get along with the American students for a long time. So after the second ones, they tried to reach me. They were like, Tony, do you want to join us to play together? If you committed your Korean students. I was like, no. And then like I was like holding the flag on my dorm. So every single morning when I wake up, the first thing I ever see is the flag.
Oh my God!
So you suddenly you have the national like pride, and you just, I mean, like over in that environment, you just want your country to become stronger, or like you want to do something eventually for the country.
And do you find this experience replicated in a lot of other people? Do you find that same thing happening to a lot of other people? They were all like draping themselves in the flag, and
maybe in Midwest, yeah. But like I don't know, like yeah. But eventually, I feel like all the Chinese students once they study abroad, they have stronger relations with the country.
Yeah, that seems to prove out in I mean, if you've seen the polling that's been done on this topic. I guess, suppose that's it. That's inevitable, and I think that happens to a lot of people when they go abroad, irrespective of where it is that they came from. Anyway, there are lots of problems, I think, that we are aware that Chinese students face, and I'm curious about your perspectives on some of these and how the students themselves could better prepare for confronting these issues, and how the institutions where they enroll could address some of these issues, maybe head off some of these issues, anticipate the issues that start. And let's start with one really obvious one, which is racism and prejudice that they encounter. So maybe tell us about your own experiences coming to the United States, still, you know, as a 15-year-old, just barely post-pubescent boy, what it was like. Did you experience overt racism? These were, yeah, nice corn-fed Midwestern boys, but right.
Like at the beginning, I feel, because that place, they don't have, not only the school, but the small town, like named Elkhorn. For our school, like for that town, like nearly like the people in that town, they barely see Chinese before. Never, probably, in their whole life. So at the beginning, some of my friends, like even in the same class, they feel like you're the weirdo, kinda. But like after you get along with them, like they're okay with that. They're kind of, maybe it's from Midwest, they're like really friendly though.
Right,
but
right.
But like I do feel kind of like the bias like towards the society. Like I do feel that. But I mean, it depends on you, like your perspective. If you really want to get along with them, you have to understand them, like what they thought. and then like you try to become like more understandable, and after that, eventually one day they will realize that though.
Yeah, I mean that's good. But did you have? I mean, so many Chinese students report having, you know, Americans come up saying, "Is it true you guys eat dog?" And then they'll, you know, they'll ask you, then hold you sort of personally responsible for oppression in Tibet, or hold you personally responsible for this. Did you encounter this sort of thing, or you know, are you a communist? That kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, like a lot of my American friends ask me these kind of questions. First, the most like popular questions is, "Do you eat dogs?" The second one is, "Do you know kung fu?" And the third one is Panda Express really the Chinese food? So I mean, like, there's a lot of like misunderstandings. From the questions, you can tell there's a lot of misunderstandings between the two cultures. But this,
you wear a T-shirt that just says no, yes, no, 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 yes. No.
Yeah, I probably can prepare one. But these questions, you can tell, is like kind of cute, since it's not like the questions that really separate you with each other, but you can tell it's the misunderstanding. But how you can tell the truth is a really hard topic. You have to stand on their perspective, tell them exactly what happened. And that is hard, really, really hard. So like, I mean, like we definitely, like when we came here, a lot of Chinese students, they tried it, and they tried it really, really hard to make the other students feel like that's, they're kind of aggressive. But if you're standing on their like standpoint, they just try to solve the misunderstandings.
So
but
how do you mean? Like they would be really assertive about their Chineseness, or?
I mean, like if you take the questions for like, for example, like the Tibet questions, uh-huh, or like the Taiwan questions.
Right.
I mean, like they definitely have different perspectives though, like between the two groups, between
right,
the Chinese students and American students. And for American students, they have this value, like build it really rooted from their like probably middle school history class,
sure,
high school class. So like it's been like 6 years for them. You cannot just persuade them with like one night. Within one night. That's impossible, though. That all the cultures are deeply rooted since the, like 6 years ago, probably, when they like just take the history class. And for the Chinese students, same. So like they actually learned from the primary school even for how China developed, all the history side. So when these two cultures like can conflict together, like either side, they have like a really strong will to persuade the other side. But the problem is that for American students, they're more like open. So once the conversation starts, they will never argue that much. But for the Chinese students, when we think the issues, like we hold the standpoint is definitely correct, we want to speak out, but we don't know which way we have to go.
Right. Which leads me to my next question, which is about their own political commitments. You've talked about your own re-embrace of the flag-raising ceremony. What about... You know, you've heard, for instance, about this woman named Yang Shuping, who was at the University of Maryland and gave a graduation address where she talked about the joy she felt at being able to breathe the clean air and to breathe the free air, you know, the atmosphere of political liberty. And, you know, while that went down very well with some American students, of course, it really pissed off a lot of Chinese students. And I'm sure that's something you remember. And there, you know, there have been other incidents like that. For example, at Duke University, near where I now live, in 2008, right after there was this conflagration in Tibet in March of 2008, and thereafter, with the Olympic torch relay approaching, there were a lot of pro-Tibet protests on a lot of campuses around the country, and it was one at Duke that happened to be, you know, met by a counter protest of Chinese students. This young woman named Grace Wong walks out into the midst of this thing, decides that sort of in an act of trying to make peace, signs something that the pro-Tibet faction was asking her to sign. And she caught all sorts of flack for that. I mean, this is something that I wonder what the correct solution is. I mean, it really boils down to how do we... deal with people who come from decidedly non-plural societies? Do we expect them to assimilate to the pluralistic values of our society, to understand, you know, the right to expression, or do we try to be deferential and maybe bow to their sensibilities and sensitivities?
I mean, like for speaking of the Tibet and also the case happened in Duke, Like, if you think about this, so if American students, they studied or exchange in China, and one of the Chinese students has a flag saying California should be the independent country, or Texas should be independent country, the American students will argue with them.
No, they wouldn't. They would probably just laugh.
Yeah.
I don't think that they would get that wrapped up about that.
Yeah, yeah. But like, if you really think about this, like, that's the difference, really the difference in the culture, though. So.
Well, yeah, yeah. That's what I'm saying. It is a very big difference in the culture. But how should institutions prepare students for that? What sorts of expectations should they set? And how, I mean, maybe how should institutions in China who are assisting in sending students to study abroad prepare their students for this?
So, I mean, like, because in the U.S., if you have the questions, a lot, like, most students will raise the questions up. They will directly ask the questions. But in China, like, people tend to hold the questions for a while, and then they collect the questions, and then they go really, really wild. So the problem is that, like, just the culture difference makes them, like, although they're in a different country, but the way they're doing things are the same. So if they really have the questions, we have to tell them, they have to raise the questions up. They have to directly talk about these questions. And I talk to a lot of, like, schools administrators, all the departments, especially the Office of International Students. They were like, we never see the Chinese faces for raising up the questions, like, for raising up the issues. If they come to the office, talk to us directly, we will have a solution. But, like for the most time, when they have the questions or, like, issues, they will just hold the issues. And eventually, people will group together to just, like, boycott or, like, do the things.
And then blow up, right?
Yeah, blow up. And when the things blow up, that is really, really serious.
Yeah, I mean, and I think they need to understand how it shapes impressions of Chinese students and how it has a very strongly negative effect. So what do you think the educational institutions here should be doing maybe to better prepare Chinese students for the experiences that they're bound to have in American classrooms, especially if they're studying, you know, history or geography or places, things where issues about Taiwan or Tibet or Tiananmen are going to come up.
Yeah, I feel like the campus right now, like, a lot of schools, they have the program, like, for, like, taking the new student, upcoming students, they have the orientations. Over the orientation events, they could tell that they're trying hard to embrace the diversity culture. And once they're reaching to that step, they could have, like, some questions listed up, like the sensitive one, and discuss up front. So, like, I mean, like, all the students reach to that step is not because they don't know the result. They definitely know the result. They definitely don't want to boycott. They definitely don't want to create a chaotic, like, for the chaos, like, for the school. But the problem is that before they enter here, no one told them what they have to do, what they should do, or what's the environment like.
So you were the president of the CSSA, the Chinese Students and Scholars Association, during your senior year at USC. What did you, was this something that you ever encountered? Were these issues that you had to sometimes deal with?
Yeah, like, for us, like, for career, like, career-wise, that's one of the most issues. Because a lot of companies in the U.S., they don't take, they don't have the visas offered for international students. So a lot of students are complaining about the unfair trade. So we have to talk to the, like, a career service office to solve this issue. But at the beginning, the school, although they try hard, but the employees, like the companies, they really don't have the views to hire the international students. Then, like, the school are actually compromising too. So they try to group us together to hold the career fair for international students only. I mean, like, for the, both of the two sides, I see, like, these two groups are trying hard to reach to the same step, same level. But, like, it takes years for them to complete this journey, though.
Yeah, but it is at least encouraging that they're both trying to do this.
They're trying hard. I can tell they're trying hard from both sides, yeah.
Right. But, you know, there's the other issues that are that surround the CSSAs right now.
Yeah.
There are all sorts of allegations that they are, for example, reporting the names of disloyal or insufficiently patriotic Chinese students to... tell us about your experience there at the CSSA. I know you're not sort of, you know, deputized to speak on behalf of all CSSAs, but about your own experiences. Did you have any overtly political issues that you had to deal with?
Not really, though. For us, like...
At USC, right?
USC, yeah. Our organization has more than 200 people, 200 okay. members in our group. And when I ever think about CSSA, I feel that's more like just a student organization. That is a student organization.
Sure.
So actually, it is my best memory of the college. So I have meet a lot of friends there, all the Chinese friends.
Right.
We meet in the organization. So it's more like the fraternity, but like in the large, like really large scale. We have like 200 students instead of like probably 20 or 40 people. And also like for our, like we only want to, like the only thing we want to do in CSSA is like just offer the service or helps for the other students.
Uh-huh.
That's it. Like for example, like-
And throw a big party for Chinese New Year.
Yeah, for Chinese New Year. And I mean like, cause I was here for 9 years and I know how hard it is for them to stay here alone though during the Spring Festival, especially when their parents making the dumplings, sending them the pictures through WeChat, and then like they will start to crying though and missing the home so much. So like as the president, I really want the students like to feel this environment is like in their hometown. So every single year we through the huge like parties, not the party, but the shows for spring, like a gala. And also we make the dumplings together.
Ah.
Yeah. So like it's more like a small home, but like it's literally the student organization. It's really free. It's just like a clean place. Yeah.
And were you ever given funding for any activities by the Chinese consulate in LA or by the embassy in DC?
Yeah, and I mean like not from the DC, but like for our side, it is not the direct funding. They actually paid the theater.
Uh-huh.
So like, cause every single year, like for us, like the scenario is.
So the theater where you would hold an event, so they would pay for the rental of a hall, and then you would have your event there or something.
Not the whole rental, but like a partial of it.
Okay.
So like, so the things actually goes in this way. So every single year we will have a spring gala for held by one of the schools in the Southern California area near the Los Angeles, and we have 35 schools down there. And so each student organization, we just like rolling. It's more like the rolling things. So every single year, this year, USC holds it. Next year, UCLA hold that. So we actually gathered all the students from the city, the Chinese students. And once they participate in the show, like we need a lot of funding though, not only from the theater, but also the food, like the gift bag, everything. So we have to prepare that like 6 months per year. It's a long journey. And we need a lot of help and the supports too, yeah.
So it's just one more of the sort of problem issues that I want to identify is it's something that I think there's some basis for perhaps. I don't know the statistics about academic integrity, mm-hmm. about the problem of cheating. There's this widespread belief. I have no idea how true it is that, you know, Chinese students are disproportionately apt to be caught for cheating and things like
this, or
plagiarism on papers and things like that. Is this a problem that you've seen at USC or that CSSA would be in any way involved in?
I mean, like the school, they have the committees for the integrities. So like all the student representatives will be selected among the whole like student garment,
right.
The USG, named the University Student Garment. So like all the different, for us, like the student organization, we never have the power to get involved into the board of that. The integrities, like the board. And the thing is that, although like some of the students might have the problem with that, but I feel like it's just like still like the difference, maybe in the culture. So in China, like, I mean, like when the students, like all the way, like they learn things, like especially learn the math, because we actually for the STEM, like I read like science, like all the fields.
Sure.
The class, like in China, they can't support the open work. So like we have the huge, like long questions, the list, we have like too many questions. So every single day we probably need to do the homework for 2 to 3 hours. And the teacher can encourage you to work together because it's too much workload. The way like you cannot probably finish by yourself. So, and until here, like the students, like they know how bad the cheating like will go. And they definitely did not do that in attention, like in intention though. They know the result, they know the risk. So like, I mean, just because that's how they actually study, or that's how they grow up with the environment, it is hard to require them to change within one night.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
Let's move on and talk a little bit about your experiences in entrepreneurship and some of your ideas about entrepreneurship. In your talk earlier today, you raised the idea that in this current political climate of suspicion, mutual suspicion, especially suspicion of Chinese technology companies from the United States, you cited the case of Huawei and their inability to close a deal with AT&T to have their phones distributed. Even Best Buy is not going to be distributing Huawei phones anymore. There's all, you know, a lot of things. You mentioned Alibaba, for example, and how they haven't made a large R&D center here. I know the company I used to work for has a fairly substantial R&D center here. Is this something that is trickling down to college students right now? Are they worried about their prospects for being able to stay in the U.S. and to work for maybe Chinese companies that are based here?
Yes, I mean, they are kind of worried. And speaking of the environment right now in the U.S., like for Huawei, I know that they have the researchers, like the Huawei schools in Britain.
Sure.
And Britain, students are like, after they graduate from college, they will get into the Huawei department, Huawei office in UK, like in London. They have a lot of opportunities because the governments down there are really open towards the Chinese companies. So the students are really like have much more opportunities compared to study here right nowadays. And you see like all the governments, their reactions, like not only necessarily like affect the students directly, but will create huge panic among them. And I feel like this panic will really like take the our process, like from Obama presidency, our friendship will take back by at least 2 years or more.
Finally, I mean, before we move on, let's talk a little bit about your thoughts on the entrepreneurial ecosystem in China and what you think Chinese students who have entrepreneurial urges should be doing. Should they bother at all right now to come to study in the U.S. when right now the premium that a haigui, a returnee, used to command on the job market back home is no longer what it used to be?
Yeah.
Should they just stay in China? Should they come here? And if they do, should they work in Silicon Valley for a few years before thinking about starting a company? You didn't.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's the environment is really different. So
right.
We feel like for U.S., that among the tech side, like in Silicon Valley, it's definitely more developed. But in China, since we have huge population and the circumstances like for using the technology is much like higher. The possibilities for using the applications are much higher compared to the US. So in China, if you like go to, especially we have the cheap labors for like delivery, all the things for like the outdoor services.
Right, for O2O, so, right.
Yeah, so the whole industry is more developed compared to the US. And if you, for example, if you are in the China, if you order the food, like for delivery, it's even cheaper than you go to the restaurant to eat by yourself.
Right.
So the whole dynamic, the whole environment makes like there's like a more opportunity for the students to start up in China. But the problem is that like over the among the tech side, we're not that developed though. So like all the students, if they want to get here, learn and try to like see the further pictures of how the entrepreneurship like goes, the history of the US like tech startups, how they grow up, they should definitely come and they should learn the experience. And once they have the experience, they can work from there. And if they really want to like focus on the service or commercial goods, they could just stay in China. I mean, like there's probably like much more like opportunities in that way.
Well, Tony, thanks so much for sharing your insights into this. I think it's really terrific. Before we let you go, let's make a couple of recommendations for our listeners. And before we do that, I do want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. Sign up for our free daily email newsletter, or better yet, join our SupChina access program for early ad-free versions of this and other podcasts, for bonus weekly roundup letters, newsletters every Friday, and for access to our Slack channel, where you can talk to our editorial team and to guests that we bring on for special chat sessions. And don't forget to leave us a positive review on the iTunes store. Thanks. And now, on to recommendations. Tony, what do you have for us by way of a recommendation?
I mean, the first and the most important thing is that no matter you're the Chinese students or you're American students, you have to really pick the thing you like most.
That's a good recommendation. Yeah.
Yeah, do that for your whole life. Because in Harvard, like we actually have a theory that every single year, 25% of the students will just get rid of their current job, not because they don't think the job is prospecting or the job like has a lot of like bright future, but because they don't have the passion anymore, they don't have the energy anymore, so they start to quit, and that lead to really the opportunity cost for them are really high, since they've been studying, preparing to enter this industry for at least 4 or 6 years, undergrad plus grad school together, and eventually one day they realize that they don't like this industry, then that really raises up the questions. And once they're at that moment, they're like probably around 26 years old, it is really hard for them to pivot. So really nowadays at this age, we should really just focus on doing the things we like most. And Jack Ma, the chairman of Alibaba, saying one thing I found is really useful and I want to share with you guys. Jack Ma told us that before you're 30, you just have to try a lot. Eventually find the things you like most. Before you're 40, you'll find the industries you want to go and go with a great leader to learn the management skills to become the true leaders. And before you're 50, you have to get out to become an entrepreneur and do the things you like most, even for the life. And after you're 60 years old, just spend the time in the beach and enjoy the life.
Sounds
seriously,
like a plan.
I think that's really important. So at this age, we have to find the things we're the most passionate with and enjoy the life, because times will never go back. And I'm kind of regret too that I don't spend a lot of time partying with my friends in the college though.
It's not too late.
This is the thing I worry most. And one more thing, so really quick. And I know like a lot of people were like questioning the relationships between two countries, China and the US. I feel like overall, like just we have to believe that the world is getting flatter. So like all the things, like all the relations will eventually become like more and more open towards each other. Because right now, if you see the trend, like all the like trades between different countries, if we don't keep the doors open, then the other country will work together. And eventually like the one who left the door closed will lose all the opportunities. If you take from the history, take the standpoint, look back to China. Like the government worked so hard to keep the doors open because they know what's the result of keeping the doors closed. They learned from the history. And right now we have to really keep the belief that we really, like the future will become much more like flatted and like all the opportunities will be shared among all the groups of people. Yeah.
Well, you're 23, so you're forgiven for quoting both Thomas Friedman and Jack Ma in your recommendation. So you don't get away for that for much longer. But anyway, I'm kidding, of course. And it's hard to follow up on like a big sort of life and global kind of recommendation like that with just a recommendation of a podcast. But I really do want to recommend this podcast by University of Pennsylvania, the UPenn Center for Contemporary China. It's an excellent podcast. It's quite new. It's hosted by a guy named Nason Mabubi, who teaches law at UPenn. In particular, the most recent episode, as of time of recording, is an hour-long interview with Damien Ma of the Paulson Institute. It's one of the best primers I've ever heard on the Chinese political economy. It is full of gems of insight, and it's really quite mind-bogglingly brilliant. So I highly recommend that you give that a listen. So yeah, that's my recommendation. Tony Gao Yutong, thank you so much for coming once again, and let's give it up for him. All right. And for the very, very good people at the Princeton U.S. China Coalition, for Jocelyn Ruckford and for Natalie Nagorski and for all the other people who invited us here, right? Yeah, let's hear it for Natalie and Jocelyn and all of you. It's a terrific event. I hope to be invited back one of these years. So thank you once again. Thanks. The Cynica podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Thanks to Jocelyn and Natalie again and all the other forum organizers for having me here. Drop us an email at cynica@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Caixin Cynica Business Brief and the GGB 996 podcast, which comes out every other week and covers tech and investing in China. We co-produce with the venture capital outfit GGB. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.